Oh. That would be the bright lights in the ice.
I think that's the sign.
Yeah, I think that's the sign that we're supposed to get started. They told us explicitly, they said, when it's time to get started, we will turn the lights on and blind you, and this is a way of calming you down and getting you ready to go. So I do wonder about the sound and lighting people.
No comment.
So anyway, we still have some people coming in, but want to get going. We have a lot of stuff to cover. I am Ben Armstrong, program manager on the Hyper-V team, and this is Didier, one of our fantastic MVPs. He's going to be helping me today, and we're going to be talking about and showing off what's new in Windows Server 2012 R2 Hyper-V.
Yes, we are.
So Didier's going to sit over here. He's actually connected back to his servers back in his homeland. And he's going to show us how all this stuff works in the real world. So before I get started, I'd like to kind of set the scene and, you know, talk about where Microsoft is going, you know, overall as a strategy with cloud computing, because this actually really helps to explain why we're investing and where we're investing in Hyper-V and why we're so excited about this. So let's do, I like audience interaction. So I'm going to be asking questions and looking for a show of hands, even though I am being blinded by the lights right now. So hopefully I can see hands go up. So how many people here have a private cloud deployed today? Now, if you had to fill out the survey, we're using private cloud. Okay, I'd say just over half the people. How many people are using services from a local hosting or service provider company? Okay, we've got a handful of people. How many people are using public cloud services, whether it's hopefully ours, but it's okay if you're using Amazon or Google. I'm just asking public cloud. I won't even ask you which one you're using. So once again, about half. So we have a vision at Microsoft that we've been calling the hybrid cloud, because for the last 5-6 years now, I've been talking to people about cloud computing. And one of the most common things that happens is I start talking about cloud computing and people go, wait, do you mean public, private? Do you mean software as a service? Do you mean infrastructure as a service? And what happens is when I start talking more to them about it, what I really find out is for the last couple of years, everyone's been kind of nervous about, you know, this multi-dimensional, what does cloud mean? And what people are nervous about is people are making investments in these different cloud computing models today. You know, we just saw it. We have private cloud, we have public cloud, so on. And what people are nervous about is, did I choose the right one? You know, and there's been kind of this sense that people have been like, you know, sooner or later, you know, people are, you know, Microsoft's going to go like, oh, it's all public cloud, or it's all private cloud. And if I chose the wrong one, then that's going to be a cost. That's going to be a problem. I'm going to be locked into the wrong platform. And to be honest, this is something that we at Microsoft spent a lot of time thinking about ourselves. And the conclusion that we came to was that the reality is that the future isn't public cloud, the future isn't private cloud, the future isn't hosted cloud, the future is all of these things where it makes sense. You know, and when we, I found this is a good dim spot. There aren't lights in my eyes right here. I'm just gonna stand very still. What our honest expectation is our honest expectation is that in 5 to 10 years' time, we're going to be talking to companies and we're going to find that most people are doing some public cloud, some private cloud. And sure, we also expect there will be some companies who are all public cloud or all private cloud, but we expect that's going to be the minority case. We expect that the majority case is going to be this hybrid deployment. And the thing that really excites us at Microsoft is that we are in the best position to deliver a hybrid cloud solution. We already have fantastic technology for private cloud. We have Hyper-V, we have System Center, we have Windows Azure Pack. We can stand up a fantastic private cloud on that platform. But that same technology is being used to power Azure. I keep on telling people this, and people are still surprised by it. Windows Azure runs on stock Windows Server running Hyper-V. You download Windows Server from MSDN and you install it on a box, you're running the same thing that we're running in Azure. And I have fun with this, because we get up on stage and we talk about like all the cool things that we're doing with our public cloud. And I'm in the back of the room going like, yep, that's my software. It's like we were talking about at the keynote. We said, hey, the launch of Titanfall, we had, 100,000 virtual machines. Yep, on Hyper-V. It's running in Azure, but that's on Hyper-V. All the discussion around the Sochi Olympics. Yep, on Hyper-V. And the great thing is, this means that more than any other company out there, we can tell you, yeah, you can build on Azure, you can build private cloud, and if your business needs change, you can move your workload where it makes sense. And this is really, kind of our North Star, is building a cloud platform that we can use ourselves for our own public cloud offerings, and that we can then give to you to build private clouds and to have hosted services built on top of. And the great thing about this, and I'll be calling this out as I go through features and so on, is we have features and concepts flowing in all directions here. There are features that we've done in Windows Server 2012 R2, which honestly, we didn't hear about it from you guys. We heard about it from ourselves. We found that when we were doing public cloud on Azure, hey, this is a problem, we need to go fix it. And once we'd done the work for Azure, we're like, fine, we're going to integrate it into Windows Server. Conversely, we have features that we built in Windows Server because we heard from people running private cloud that this is what they needed. And once we built them, we turned around and said, hey, we need to light that up in Azure as well. And so it's a great time to be seeing this innovation across the platform. So before I dig into 2012 R2, I do want to do a quick recap of Windows Server 2012. And some of you may be groaning about this, but there's an important reason for this. The first reason is not everyone is on 2012, so let's do a show of hands here. How many people have deployed 2012 R2 already? Okay, about half the room. How many people are still on 2012? Okay, about a quarter. How many people are still on 2008 R2? About a third. Those numbers don't add up. I think some people put their hands up twice. So, three times? Come on. So we have about a third of the room who are still running 2008 R2, and I'll be honest, 2012 was a huge release for us. We put a lot of features in it. 2012 R2 is another huge release. So here is, and I'm not going to go through all of this, here is a bunch of features. This is the features that we did in 2012 R2. We did just as many in 2012. And I actually have people come up to me and ask me, hey, Ben, when are you going to do this? And I look at them and say, we shipped that a year ago. This happens all the time. So 2012 was a huge release for us on a number of fronts. Now, one of the ones was scale. Now, here are our numbers for scale for 2012. And really, the mission that we set ourselves with 2012 is we went, okay, we want to deliver a virtualization platform that can virtualize anything. So when we were selling Windows Server 2008 R2, we would go out and we would talk to customers and we would get people who were really enthusiastic about virtualization. And they would say to me, Hey, Ben, we love virtualization. We virtualize everything. I said, really? You virtualize everything? That's amazing. And they'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, really? Really? Do you really virtualize everything? Come on, look me in the eye. And they would say, well, almost everything. And when we pushed on them and said, okay, so what haven't you virtualized? Let me tell you, the answer was always the same. The answer was, well, we've virtualized everything except that SQL cluster. And so we spent a lot of time in 2012 working on our scalability, working on our availability, working on our reliability so that we could virtualize those SQL clusters. And that's what actually drove a lot of these figures. So the scale numbers, the support for 4 terabyte, the support for 1 terabyte of memory, so on. Now, something I like to point out here is these scale numbers are pretty crazy. And I'll be honest, I've had conversations with customers where I've showed them these numbers, and they're just like, eh, those numbers are so large, we don't believe them. You're just making numbers up now. Like, no one does that. So I want to be really clear. These scale numbers are numbers that we tested at load at. We know we can hit these numbers. And all of these numbers, you know, this isn't some theoretical so on. These are numbers that we tested at load at. So there is a demo that I've been trying to figure out how to do. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do it today because it's a logistical nightmare. But just one number I'd like to call out and highlight here. So you'll see here, we say we support 1 terabyte of memory per virtual machine. So a couple of fun facts about this. The first one is, yes, we do have multiple servers in our test lab with over 1 terabyte of memory. I remember the first time we got one of those set up, I went down to the test lab as it was coming in, and one of our test engineers held a single stick of memory in his hands, and he looked at me and he said, Ben, this is worth more than my house. But one of the bars that we set ourselves for that memory scale goal, was we said, we are not going to sign off on saying we support 1 terabyte of memory unless we can reliably, repeatedly live migrate a 1 terabyte VM that's running an active SQL workload and do it in under 5 seconds so we maintain the network connection. And let me tell you, we can. Now, the reason why we've never demonstrated this is because even with really good networking, it actually takes about 40 minutes to get 1 terabyte of data across the connection. So the whole live migration takes about 40 minutes, but we don't drop the connectivity, we get the system across. You know, so we've been really hardcore with these numbers about making sure there's no fiction in here and there's no workload we can't run. Another thing that we did in 2012 was we really pushed the boundary on performance of storage. You know, so we had some great demonstrations around the scale we can get for throughput to storage. You know, and it boggles my mind that I still get people come up to me and say, Ben, I'm not sure if you guys, you know, can perform at the level that I need for my workload. Like, trust me, we can. So I'm about to hand over to Didier for our first demo, but before I do that, I'd like to ask, how many people here are familiar with, and this is a 2012 technology, with ODX? Okay, we've got a showing of hands. How many people here actually have ODX working in their environment? We got a smaller showing of hands. So ODX is one of the 2012 investments that we made, and it's something we're really excited about, and it's one of the reasons why we're going to highlight it here. ODX is a storage hardware offload where we're able to do some pretty insane performance things if you have a SAN infrastructure that supports it. So I'm going to switch across to Didier now, and he's going to show us what his setup can do.
So basically, we're just going to have some fun. So we're going to demonstrate two technologies. One is ODX, and the other is UNMAP, and they can work hand in hand, so that's quite an easy thing to do for us. So first, look on the screen and you can see the space that is actually being used on the SAN in the backend. So as you can see, I've created a LAN of 10.5 terabytes, but there is only 42 gigabytes consumed. And then we have another script that shows you the size of the virtual disks that are living on the file system on the CSV. And it flickers a bit because it's refreshing all of the time, because otherwise it wouldn't be that interesting to you. So we're running a virtual machine where we have mapped all these drives to several controllers. And this is that machine. I've got a bunch of scripts, and we're just going to start copying data. And by doing that, we're going to demonstrate ODX and unmap. And I promise you, copying files will never have been this interesting. So first, we do a fixed VHD. We're copying about 4 gigs of ISOs. That was nice, wasn't it? I kind of like it. My users kind of like it as well. And there's the VHDX. And what can you see? It's going to vary a bit, but the performance won't differ very much. Why is that? It's ODX. Both can handle offload to the SAN.
Now, let me just do a survey here. Because a long time ago, I was actually a server administrator, and I've done large data transfers. Who here has ever been late getting home for dinner because they were waiting for the files to finish copying? Okay? Was your significant other happy with you when you came home late for dinner? I swear, I almost got divorced in my early marriage for waiting for files to copy. So this is really cool stuff to see.
So pay attention. You've seen on the SAN that we are consuming a bit more space. And as well, you can see, well, you can't see anything yet because those were fixed VHDs. So they were 50 gigabytes. They're still 50 gigabytes. We just put some data in there. Now let's do the same trick. And let's take a dynamically expanding VHD. And there we go. Not that impressive. While we're doing this, let's do something else. Let's start a dynamically expanding VHD. The VHDX, I mean, sorry. Oh, that's a lot better. So what could the difference be here? We've just seen that we've got ODX on both. Well, they're both on a SCSI controller, virtual SCSI controller. So what's the difference? Well, the difference is dynamically expanding VHDXs are a lot more performant than they used to be. And I have to say, I was pretty amazed the first time I ever saw it. So it's all good. As you can see, they have both expanded. And actually, the VHD is still expanding because it's slow. And basically, Ben, I have to tell you, I'm fed up with dynamically expanding VHDs. So I don't use them anymore.
So this is actually, let's do a quick show of hands. How many people here are still using the VHD format in their environment? Okay, how many people have moved across to VHDX? Okay, so for all the people on VHD, you need to get to VHDX. It is significantly faster. And more importantly, it is safer. One of the big reasons why we built the VHDX format was that it is actually resilient to data corruption. Now, one of the things that we saw in 2008 R2 was we would occasionally get support calls from people where they'd had a power outage and the VHD was just scrambled. And what had happened was the metadata, the block allocation table in the VHD had got corrupted. There was nothing we could do. VHDX does transactional logging on that block allocation table so that even in the event of an unplanned power failure, we can ensure that data doesn't get lost. And it's much faster, as Didier was just showing.
It is. And I've done some house cleaning in the meanwhile, but I still have to do the house cleaning on the dynamically expanding VHDX. And let's do that right now. And whilst I'm doing that, I want you to keep an eye on the sizes of the VHD files on the server. You have to shift delete to make sure we do that. There we go. Now I'm going to help the system a bit. I'm gonna force retrim. Basically, this is the unmap action that's going on. It happens in the background, but of course, you have to force your luck a bit with demos, and it's kind of stupid to sit around for 2 minutes waiting for it to happen, so I just forced it. So what do we see? That's the big question. Anybody noticed? Anything? Space on the sand, indeed, it has dropped. Because unmap works on two layers. One side, you have the space efficiencies in the virtual hard disk, meaning that if you delete something, you can reuse the empty blocks, meaning that a dynamically expanding VHDX will not have to grow as often, which is an efficiency. But the unmap commands get sent down through the storage if it supports it, and you recover gigabytes, terabytes on your storage system. Also very cool. But even if you don't have unmap on your storage system, you still have the efficiencies in the virtual layer. So that's important to know.
And let me just highlight, I'm not even going to do a show of hands for this because it's not worthwhile. No one has enough storage space. This is just a fact. Everyone I talk to is trying to figure out how to get more out of their existing storage. So these sorts of investments in technologies that allow you to get more efficiency are critical to getting the value out of your deployment.
Well, we'll continue the demo. Now we have two LUNs, that are divided in two volumes, and we're going to show you that unmap works on the disk level, not on the volume level. And that's a very nice trick to do, so let's start with the VHD. And while this is copying, we'll kick off the VHDX as well. There we go. And again, you can see that there is a little performance difference between the two. And unfortunately, now I have to wait. I reduced the number of files I'm copying just to cater to the timing restraints, but you get the message, I guess.
Now, one thing I would like to highlight is this is all technology that shipped in 2012. Now, we've done further improvements on this in 2012 R2, but this is something that you really should be looking at. And for a lot of people, and this is really frustrating for me as the software guy, there are a lot of people out there who actually have hardware that would support this. They just need to put a firmware update from the vendor on there. You know, so you know, whatever storage infrastructure you have, you need to be going out to your storage vendor and saying, hey, do you support this technology? Are there updates that I should be aware of?
That's a very observant remark.
Yeah, I have this conversation all the time. The number of times I talk to people and they're like, oh, we have EMC, we have NetApp, we have so on. And I'm like, have you got the latest firmware on there? And they're like, those things have firmwares?
Okay. Now we're going to do the demo a bit. We're going to take it a bit further. What we're going to do now is, well, it sounds stupid, but we're going to delete the data again immediately from both the volume on the VHD, shift delete, and from volume one on the dynamically expanding VHDX. Here we go. And now we're going to go back to our scripts, and we're going to repeat the exercise. Why? Well, because we can. We love doing this stuff. So I misplaced my scripts, I think. Yeah. Hang on. There they are. So let's now do volume two and watch what happens. Watch at the disk size of those two volumes per LUN, dynamically expanding VHD and dynamically expanding VHDX. So let's first kick off the VHD. And let's look at it. What do you see? It is still expanding. It has to grow. Now, meanwhile, because it takes a while, we'll do the same for the dynamically expanding VHDX and watch the size. It's not growing, or a little bit. Why is that? Unmap. Trim ran in the background, and I was saved by the demo gods because I forgot to run retrim manually. But it kicked in time, and it shows that you are reusing those deleted blocks. The VHDX file knows about it, so it doesn't have to expand, giving you performance benefits. And basically, that's unmap in action, and the copy speeds have demonstrated what ODX can do for you. And this is technology we use in production since almost day one. since the moment we got the firmware for the SAN, actually. Why? Because we need it. It's not something that's just in the lab or in a million IOPS demos or at TechEd. This is production ready. It's not a production system. My boss would not like that. But this is the proving grounds for what we use. So now the rest of the magic. What happens if you shut down a virtual machine? Let's do that. Let's first run Trim, because the demo gods might not be with us twice. And I always like to do it twice, for good measure. Call me paranoid. Okay. Now let's shut down the virtual machine. And again, watch a couple of things. The disk sizes. Well, we're not having much.
You forgot to delete the files before you shut it down.
Did it?
Yeah.
Did I? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
You didn't delete them after the final copy.
Okay, there we go.
It's all good. Let's move along.
Let's move along. Okay. Well, you have seen it somewhere else. This is in the first file we tested.
Yep.
In the VHD.
The first file went down.
This one went back to its original size, and indeed, I forgot to delete the files. I should put it in the script.
You should.
I should. Okay, let's stop with this one. I want to leave you with another impression of what ODX can do. This is copying files, but ODX is leveraged at many fronts. Shrinking or extending a VHDX, that's where ODX comes in. If you want to do storage live migration, ODX can help you. You have less CPU cycles, less data to be transported over the wire. And even for creating VHDs, it's quite a nice thing to do. So I'm going to get this out of the way so you can see better. And we are going to demonstrate creating VHDXs of several sizes on a CSV. And actually, this is not the speediest demo, because CSV has a bit of overhead with metadata updates, but it will still be sufficiently impressive, I think. Oh, hang on. I'm gonna cancel it. Run it as admin. That will be better. There we go. So, basically, what you're seeing here is VHDX is being created. 50 gigabytes, 500, a terabyte, we're just playing. And look at the speeds. I don't know how many of you know how long it takes to create a 500 gigabyte or a terabyte VHDX if you don't have ODX.
So let me just say, I do not have ODX in my home environment, and I do know how long it takes to create a terabyte fixed VHD. In my house, it takes 6 hours.
Oh. Well, in my house. let's see how long it takes.
6 hours, and let's see if it's any faster here.
I'll try. I'll do my utmost best. Wait for it. I'm sorry for the delay, by the way. Yeah, sorry. I didn't get below 15 seconds, Ben.
Now, if only I could convince my wife to let me buy an ODX-enabled SAN for the house.
I can help you with that. So we'll let this run, and basically that was a demo of what ODX can do for you. And I can tell you my administrators appreciate this a lot, because now when they get a request creating a 500 gig VHDX, they just do click-click or launch a PowerShell script, and it's done. And it's beats the previous edition, let's put it that way. There we go. If you can do the math, you can see how many terabytes we created in how many seconds. And I still think today this is quite impressive. Ben?
Yep. So, that was just a recap of some of the things that we did in 2012. So what did we do going into 2012 R2? Well, to be honest, we spent a lot of time listening to people who are deploying private clouds and listening to what we were seeing inside of Azure, and trying to continue to push things forward to address pain points and to further refine the platform. So there were a number of areas where we got feedback. So we got feedback about, hey, Windows Server DOS and licensing. Giving us unlimited licensing is great, But the way you've done it doesn't work for a service provider. We got feedback around OS deployment being difficult. We got feedback, and I mean, we continue to get feedback that like, hey, all the storage stuff you've done is cool, but do more. And the final thing we got feedback on was, I'm still not virtualizing that SQL cluster. And so we've done more work there. So let's start digging into what we've done for each of these and what the problems are. So the first thing that's really interesting, and this is something that we've been spending a lot of time thinking about and working on, is if you look at the way that we designed Hyper-V in Windows Server 2008 R2 and in Windows Server 2012, we were really designing for a world of an enterprise running some virtual machines. And what we've found is we're now in a world where even in an enterprise, but definitely in a hoster, the people who run software inside the virtual machines are completely different from the people who run the physical hardware and manage the fabric. And I find this fascinating, and it's actually something I've been chatting to my people about, is because we spend a lot of time as we're thinking about these features and pulling them together, where we kind of do storyboarding. You know, we go, okay, here's the way the feature's going to work. First, this is going to happen, then that's going to happen, and so on. And here's how we think that it happens. And what we've found is we've gone from a world where you would have a team of people running virtual machines and managing them. And we're now in a world where if the person who's running some software inside a virtual machine even has to talk to the person who's maintaining the physical computers, people are already unhappy. You know, that's already a failure. I mean, we had, you know, a show of hands, like I know we had the people who are using local service providers. How many people, when you hit something where you're like, oh, I have to ring up your service provider, go, yay, I like talking to him. Any hands? No? Another one which I love, and I mean, this, let's see if we can set up some antipathy in the crowd. I think that's always a good thing to get the audience against each other. No. First, a show of hands. How many people here are their organization's domain administrator? Okay. Now, let's reverse this. How many people here are not the domain administrator? Okay, if you're not the... No, keep your hands up. If you're not the domain administrator... Now, keep your hands up if you're happy if you ever have to call the domain administrator in order to ask him to do something. No wavering. we got a person.
I don't have a t-shirt to throw.
So this is actually really interesting for us. You know, because we're now starting to look at this and going, okay, how do we enable these solutions in a way where, you know, and side note, talk to your domain administrators. They're lovely people. It's okay. They won't bite your head off. But you know, we're looking at how do we enable things to just work in an environment where the administrator of the virtual machine doesn't want to talk to the administrator of the hypervisor. Automatic activation is an example of this. What we actually do is we've built the infrastructure now where if the host is correctly licensed with Windows Server Data Center and you install Windows Server inside the virtual machine, you don't need to go to, you know, our activation service and so on. What happens is the virtual machine is able to reach out to the host, go, oh, you're licensed with Data Center? Great, I'm licensed too. And there's no extra step required. This makes things fantastically simple. Let me highlight, this is also awesome for demo environments. Oh, because here's another show of hands. How many people have set up a demo and 3 hours before they went on stage had activation trigger in all their virtual machines? Got a couple of hands. That's happened to me. It is great because now you make sure the host is activated and good, and it just works in the virtual machines. Now, something to call out whenever we talk about this, you know, immediately we get people going like, oh, you'll have restricted that to some channel. No. This is not restricted to any channel, OEM, VL, full license, you know, all the various licensing schemes. We just care, is the host activated? Yes, if it is, the virtual machines are also activated. So that makes things fantastically simpler. The next thing that we did was we actually had some fun. You know, we took a step back and looked at where do we want to be moving things with virtual machines. Now, let's see if we can do a virtualization quiz. Oh, by the way, Hyper-V MVPs, I know where you are. You're not allowed to answer this question. If you're not a Hyper-V MVP, how many people know? Actually, we'll just do a. I'll pick someone for a show of hands. Who knows what the motherboard is that we show inside of a virtual machine? Does anyone know what motherboard we expose inside a virtual machine? No one knows. I might have to ask a Hyper-V MVP. Hyper-V MVPs, does anyone know the motherboard inside of a virtual machine? You're letting me down. Do you? It's an Intel 440BX. Yeah. Now, an Intel 440BX was released in 1995.
And
the way we do virtual machines in 2012 and earlier is we try really hard to make a virtual machine that looks and feels like a physical computer. And I'll be honest, we're kind of at breaking point on that whole concept. You know, we've found some interesting bugs. For instance, no one ever expected to see a 1995 era 440BX motherboard with 64 processors in it. You know, that comes as there are some operating systems that get a bit confused by that. And we're constantly kind of walking this edge. And we sat down and we said, wait a second. It's not 1995. You know, it's now 2013, 2014. Operating systems today know about virtual machines. They've been designed for virtual machines. So let's create a new type of virtual machine that has no pretense and is just a virtual machine. And that's where we came up with the concept of Generation 2 virtual machines. This is a new platform that's included in Windows Server 2012 R2, which no longer pretends to be a physical computer. We no longer have a BIOS system, we're UEFI based, and we only have virtual devices inside the system. So what does this look like? Well, the first thing to know is they're very easy to create. You get 2012 R2, you go through, there's an option to create a Generation 2 virtual machine, and everything else looks and feels the same. But the big difference is once you get installed and up and running. So here's a couple of places. On the left here, I've got the settings for Generation 1 virtual machine. On the right, I have the settings for Generation 2 virtual machine, and you'll notice that a whole bunch of things are missing. And this is because we no longer need them. So we no longer have an IDE controller because we can boot off of a SCSI controller. We no longer have legacy network adapters because we can boot off of our virtual network adapter. There's a whole lot of simplicity in the architecture. And once you get an operating system installed in here, you'll see even more. So I love this. This is, on the left, we have Device Manager from inside a Generation 1 virtual machine. And there are some great things in here. My favorite one, let's see if we've got this on the screenshot, is the Busmaster IDE controller. No, we don't have my favorite one. There's actually, if you go digging through Device Manager, there's actually a PCI to ISA bridge somewhere in the Generation 1 virtual machine, for all those ISA devices that you need in your virtual machines. And if you look at Generation 2, none of that's there. Now, this makes the system a lot simpler, it makes it a lot easier, it makes it a lot more flexible. Honestly, it also makes it more secure. We've got less code running, we have less complexity in the system. So here, I'm not going to talk through all of this. This is a nice little chart for you to look at later, where we go through and we talk about all the changes in Generation 2 virtual machines. Now, at this stage, I do want to be clear, because people are kind of interested in Generation 2 virtual machines. I want to be clear that this is a forward-looking investment for us. I have a lot of people come to me and say, like, hey, what are all the cool things I can do with Generation 2 virtual machines that I can't do with Generation 1 virtual machines? Well, today, actually not that much. There are a couple of key features. The first one, obviously, I've already talked about, you can boot off of SCSI and you can boot off of virtual network adapters. You don't need to have IDE and legacy network adapters. That's great. The next one is Generation 2 virtual machines support secure boot, which is a great feature which protects you from kernel mode attacks inside your virtual machine. The final thing, and I do want to be really clear about this, is I get a lot of people who come to me and be like, Generation 2 virtual machines are great because they're really fast, right? It's like, no, because Generation 1 virtual machines are really fast. You know, Generation 1 virtual machines, we're usually within like 95 to 98% of native performance. That said, there are a couple of areas where Generation 2 virtual machines really shine. My favorite example of this is OS installation time. If you have 2012 R2, try this, grab some install media, and create a Generation 1 and a Generation 2 virtual machine and start them installing at the same time. What you're going to see is the Generation 2 virtual machine finishes a lot sooner. So there are drawbacks. You know, we have really kind of thrown out the kitchen sink and started over again with this platform. So they're 64-bit virtual machines only. I should have updated this slide because it's finally being announced. So we support Windows 8, 2012, and later guests. We've actually just had support for Linux go into the mainline kernel, and it has been picked up by the latest build of Ubuntu. If you get Ubuntu 14.04, it should work inside a Generation 2 virtual machine. And the final thing to note is, yes, we continue to support Generation 1 virtual machines. So you can come across and everything works fine. But we're really excited about what we can do with Generation 2 virtual machines moving forward. Another big area of investment is actually one of my favorite features, is what we call the enhanced virtual machine experience. Now, and the story I like to tell here is, I spend a lot of time going out and talking to customers and trying to understand like what their pain points are. And generally speaking, you either get big pain points that everyone complains about, and you're like, okay, we need to go and work on that. Or you get small pain points that you hear from one person, maybe two people. And those ones you go like, okay, I'll throw them on the pile, and if we get to it, we get to it, but fine. This one fascinates me because there is a small pain point that I heard from everyone. And this was, we'd be talking to people and we're like, hey, you know, so do you have any feedback on the usability of, you know, Hyper-V or virtual machines and so on? And consistently, the one thing that I would hear time and time again is, Ben, I really, really need to be able to copy and paste some text into the virtual machine. Just make that work, please. And that's what we've done. So with enhanced VM interaction, we've actually done that and a lot more. What we've done is we have enlightened remote desktop to be fully aware of virtual machines. So now, if you install the latest version of Windows on top of Windows Server 2012 R2 or on top of Windows 8.1, when you connect using the Hyper-V tools, you get all the integration features of remote desktop without having to have a network connection. You know, so you can copy and paste, but you also get sound. You get nice video performance. You can actually copy and paste files. You get all the integration that you want without having to have the network connection working, which is, trust me, once you start using this, it will really annoy you if you have to go back to a system that doesn't have it. So that's the first round of feedback that we got. The second round of feedback that we got was around storage. You know, we got requests about we need to be able to resize storage online. We need to have better storage SLAs. We need to have a better story around clustering. We need to have more improvements in deduplication. So we worked on all of these. So we now support online resize of virtual hard drives. So key things to point out, this is both grow and shrink Everyone is surprised by that, but we can shrink it as well. It is for SCSI disks only, and it is for VHDX only. Once again, please use VHDX. One thing to highlight, interesting nuance, because it's for SCSI disk only, this also means for generation 2 virtual machines, we can do it for the boot drive. And that is something that Windows supports, and it works just fine. The number of people that come up and say, can you do that? Like, can you resize a boot partition on Windows? And it's like, yes, you can. Being able to do it since Windows Vista. So that's all fully supported. And it's supported with Linux. So great functionality for increasing uptime. Little animation. The next area we've invested is in storage costs. This is a really interesting problem, and we've had some discussions here where we're, and once again, this is we're starting to look at, hey, what does it mean to do this in a public cloud, in a service provider cloud? And one of the stories that we've heard time and time again is, you know, I'll be running a set of workloads, and one of the workloads will go hot. You know, someone will kick off a SQL database workload, and all of a sudden, other people's virtual machines will start running slowly. And the problem is, with Windows Server 2012, you don't have a great way to deal with that. And unfortunately, what we've heard is that if it's a really bad situation, sometimes, you know, the way people deal with that is by just turning off the offending virtual machine. That's not a solution. No one is happy in this scenario. So what we've done is in 2012 R2, we now have storage costs built in. And this allows you, on a per virtual hard drive basis, to go in and throttle, you know, how much IOPS a virtual machine gets. And you can do this dynamically while the system is running. And a little highlight, works with generation 1 and generation 2. Now, one of the problems I have is everyone assumes, like, oh, this will be a generation 2 feature only. No. We've done a lot of work to make sure that as many features as possible work with generation 1 virtual machines as well. So now I'm going to switch across to Didier, who's going to give us a demo of storage costs.
As you might have gathered from the ODX and the unmap demos, I work in an environment where we do a lot of data movement. And I think Ben built this one especially for me, because I love it. So let's get rid of the old demo, and let's take a look. Basically, here we have a virtual machine. I have IOMeter running, and we're going to create some IOPS. And we're going to go to the settings of the virtual machine. And we are going to go to the second disk where the demo is running against. And in advanced features, we have given it ample of IOPS. It's a bit, let's say, exaggerated. I will not get that, but let's see what it gives. Basically, this is the bad virtual machine. This is the one that's annoying all the other customers. There we go. So basically, it's taking away all the IOPS it can get. And now we need to do something and tell our other customers that we'll take care of their needs. So let's limit this one to 2,000. Click Apply. And see what happens. Immediately, the virtual machine is limited to the maximum IOPS. And this has been a lifesaver for us. The fact that we can do this, so we can keep the original VM running, and we can satisfy the needs of all our other virtual machines. We just love this functionality.
And the best thing is, as Didier just shown, you can do this dynamically. You know, so if you have, you know, situations where, hey, at nighttime, we're okay for this virtual machine to use lots of IOPS, but during business hours, we need to make sure that's available. You can do that. You can automate this and have that sort of responsiveness.
If they bribe me, I can up it again.
Yeah, if people want to pay Didier inside his company to get a bit more throughput, then they can do that.
So let's simulate this. There we go.
Yeah, fantastic.
So that was the demo, and I'll hand it off to Ben again. Okay. Oh, that's the wrong one. Here we go.
So one thing I'd just like to highlight before I move off of storage costs is Didier has actually done some awesome blog posts that go into great details about a whole bunch of functionality that's in storage costs that we're not going to cover today because I would be speaking for 3 hours. So I would really encourage, if this is interesting to you and you want to understand what more you can do, I have a link there. It's going to be available afterwards. But otherwise, you can go to your preferred web search engine.
Yes.
And type in storage costs working hard in IT. And then you'll find his post straight away. And fantastic stuff to read. So the next thing we did on storage was guest clustering. And this was a fascinating experience for us because, as I said, we've been really focused on how can I virtualize that SQL cluster. And we did some work in 2012. We added support for our virtual fiber channel. And what we heard was that's great for very specific enterprise scenarios. What's not great for is if I'm rapidly provisioning virtual machines and throwing them away, because I don't want to have to do LUN management every time I provision a new cluster. It's also not great for hosters and service providers, because they do not want to be exposing their underlying storage fabric to the user, you know, which is what was required in order to use virtual fiber channel. So what we've done is we've built shared VHDX functionality. And the way we do this is we require that you have a VHDX file that is residing on either a CSV volume or a scale-out file server. And we're able to use the highly available semantics of that to then provide a highly available hard disk through to the virtual machines. So what this looks like from a VM configuration point of view is you're able to go in and just say, OK, I want to add this VHD to these two virtual machines and share it. And when you say and share, we go out and check, hey, is this actually sitting on highly available storage that supports the semantics we need and so on. But if it is, that's all. No, you now have a guest cluster which you can set up. And what now happens is that hard disk shows up inside the virtual machine as a SAS disk. And you're able to set up Windows clustering on top of it without having to be aware of the underlying fabric. And that's one of the big requests. And it's one of the things I've been pushing people on, is my belief is that there are a lot of people out there that have virtualized SQL workloads and virtualized file servers, which if they were honest with themselves, they probably should have clustered them. And they haven't clustered them because it was so painful. And so I've been highlighting to people, Server 2012 R2, creating a guest cluster is no longer painful. You know, you should really go back and look at your existing virtualized workloads and go, you know, hey, this SQL server, do we want it to be clustered? Do we want it to be highly available inside the virtual machine? So the final thing that we added on storage was deduplication for running virtual machines. And Windows Server 2012, we added functionality for deduplication, but we didn't support it for running virtual machines. In 2012 R2, we're now supporting it for running virtual machines, but only for VDI deployments. And I often get asked from people, hey, Ben, why are you saying only for VDI deployments? Like, is there some black magic that goes on here that makes it work for VDI but not for other deployments? The reality is we say only for VDI deployments because that's the situation we've done exhaustive testing on. So it's not supported for non-VDI deployments. We haven't done enough testing of all the various server workloads to feel confident saying that you should turn that on. But for VDI deployments, this can be a huge space saving by enabling online deduplication. The final thing, there are actually two final things I'd like to call out on storage. The first one is we didn't stop with performance. We have continued to increase our performance. We haven't made that big of an issue around this because a million IOPS is more than enough for most people, which is what we did in Windows Server 2012. But in Windows Server 2012 R2, we can now do up to 1.6 million IOPS from a single virtual machine. With any luck, you know, next release I'll be up here talking about how we're even faster still. The final thing that we did was actually a really interesting feature, and I like this a lot, is we now allow you to do live export of a running virtual machine. And this is a great troubleshooting tool. You can have a running virtual machine, you want to do some analysis, you want to look at it, you can just click on it, say export it, say clone it, and we will give you a live copy of that virtual machine. So that's the work that we did around storage. But we did more work. There's a huge set of features that we've worked on here. We've worked on what can we do to improve networking performance? What can we do to improve networking uptime? We've worked on what can we do to improve live migration? And what can we do to improve replica? I'm running out of time, by the way, so I'm starting to pick up my pace. So we added some features around network availability. We introduced this concept of a protected network. And what this means is that if you have clustered Hyper-V, and you have a dedicated network for your cluster, and you have a separate network for your virtual machines, if we detect a connectivity problem on your virtual machine network, let's say, you know, there's a bad cable. What we'll do, or a cable gets tripped on, it gets pulled out, and now one of your nodes is disconnected. We will actually detect that. We will also detect that, hey, network connectivity is working over on a different box in the cluster. And we will move the virtual machines automatically to a node in the cluster which is still connected to the network. So just providing extra levels of guarantees there. The next feature we implemented was a feature called virtual RSS, or VRSS. This is really fascinating. The basic problem that we're trying to solve with VRSS is you don't really see this if you're running gigabit. But how many people here now have 10 gigabit networking in their environment? Okay? Have you seen what happens to your CPU when you really push that? Yeah, I just saw this man wince. So one of the interesting problems is once you start getting 10 gig connectivity in your environment, you actually soon hit a situation where you're no longer limited by your bandwidth, you're limited by the amount of CPU you have available to push data. VRSS allows us to distribute the CPU workload across multiple processors in order to get the highest performance inside virtual machines. So this is unfortunately not enabled by default. You have to enable it. Here are the steps. You can either go in and enable it through Device Manager, or we have a PowerShell commandlet for doing it. I meant to put a demo slide in there, and I didn't. Okay. So I'm going to switch across to Didier, who's going to give us a demo of VRSS.
Well, we need two machines for this. This is number one. That's too big. Let's try that again. My complex passwords. This one can go. We don't need it anymore. Basically, I have a little command set up that will receive and send data between two virtual machines, pushing it to the limits. So we'll take the second virtual machine, the receiving one. This is the most important one to watch. There we go. So we're going to have a look at the CPU on this machine. As you can see, it's a nice virtual machine. It has 10 gigs of RAM. It has 8 virtual CPUs. And we set it up so that it can receive data. On the other one, we send data. Now, when it kicks in, watch the speed and watch the CPUs. How do you like them numbers?
So this is just two virtual machines running on the same server doing intense network transfer. And what are we currently seeing? We're seeing over 30 gigabit. I've actually seen this demo occasionally touch 40 gigabit of transfer going between these two virtual machines. So that's amazing performance on networking. And once again, this is just all focused on how can we get it so that you can virtualize every workload.
And we're pretty happy with that because we transfer a lot of data. And while ODX helps out, we don't have use of it everywhere. And then this comes into play. So it doesn't get any better than this. And it works with live migration.
Yes, it does. So speaking of which, let's switch back to the slides and we'll talk about the work that we did in live migration.
Let's do that. Here we go.
So we did a huge amount of investment in live migration in 2012 R2. The first thing that we did was we invested in cross-version live migration. So you can live migrate a virtual machine from Windows Server 2012 to Windows Server 2012 R2 with zero downtime. And it just works out of the box. And let me tell you, this was one of the features that I pushed for most heavily. And the story I told the development team, because let me tell you, they weren't happy. They were like, Ben, this is a bunch of work. Are you serious? Like, we're going to have to go through and do all this infrastructure for it. And I said to them, I said, look, here's the deal. We are ramping up to ship Windows Server 2012 R2 within, I believe we did it 14 months after 2012. So I'm like, within 12 to 14 months. I'm like, I'm going to get to Tech Ed, and I'm going to talk about all the features in 2012 R2. And there will be people in the room who are in the middle of deploying 2012. And if we don't have a great story for them, I'm going to get fruit thrown at me when I'm on stage. So we did a lot of work to make sure that this works. Now the best thing for me, I love this, is when we did the work to enable you to do live cross-version live migration, and we were really focused on, okay, how do we make it possible to do zero downtime upgrade? We kind of accidentally enabled cross-version everything else. So safe state, that now works cross-version. Snapshots, checkpoints, those work cross-version. You know, so here's another fun show of hands. Who here has had the experience of doing an in-place upgrade of a Windows server and then finding out that they had to delete all their virtual machine snapshots because they weren't compatible with the new platform? We've got a couple of people here. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, you do an in-place upgrade from 2012 to 2012 R2, your snapshots continue to work. So just making it easier to get to the new platform. The next thing that we did was we did investment in making live migration faster. And we've provided two technologies. We've got compression and SMB Direct on RDMA. So we're running out of time. I'm going to skip forward, and I want Didier to show you these technologies in action.
So live migration for us became great in 2012. And we thought we were in heaven, and now we're in Valhalla. This is basically amazing what we can do now, and I'll start demoing it immediately. So let's sign out here, get this out of the way. We don't need to look at the machines for this one. And let's shut down this one. So basically we have four virtual machines. Each of them has 10 gigabits of fixed memory, and those are the ones we're going to live migrate with a script. So I'll show you the cluster and some performance monitors. So we're going to be looking at the CPU load of all the logical processors on the host. That's important. And also we're going to be looking at, well, you might have guessed, the network throughput, because that's what it's all about. We have two 10 gigabit cards in here. They are Mellanox cards. And we'll configure the performance options on the fly so you can see the difference. So let's start off. Let's see if the script works. Yes, it does. Start. Oh, that's twice, I think. Oh, Ben. Did I lose my...
Oh. No, it's all good.
Oh, I'm still here. So first we're going to do a TCP/IP. That's what you had in 2012. It was amazingly better than it was in 2008 R2. Let's kick it off. And basically, the script is now live migrating those virtual machines. So let's have a look at the bandwidth. Blue is the one that is sending, and green is the one on the receiving hosts, and that's receiving. It's at line speed. It has very nice performance. Look at the CPU load, just as a comparison, get a mental picture of it, and see what this does for you. So you can see you fill up the two pipes quite nicely, but it's one pipe on the sending one, and the other one is on the receiving end. So it's one NIC being used on the source host and on the target host. That's a limitation of having TCP/IP. There is no way, except for teaming, to aggregate bandwidth. So that's 41 seconds for the first one. So that's four virtual machines with 10 gigabyte of RAM. So that's quite nice. And we'll be done here soon. And we'll demo another option we have now, which is quite impressive to speed things up, especially if you have 1 gigabit. And I apologize for the delay. But
this is all part of doing a realistic demonstration.
Yeah. So again, this is the hardware technology we use in production. And it's a lifesaver. Why? Because we have large memory virtual machines. We have virtualized our entire SQL Server environment. We have, oh, look at that, 40.5. It's not bad. I'll leave it to Ben to discuss anything he wants. Those are just my remarks here. So let's go to the next one. And that's compression. So the script has switched the performance option to compression. And now let's see what happens, especially pay attention to the CPUs. So the live migration kicks off. Holy, what was that? Don't be afraid of this. This is just the use of idle CPU cycles. So if the hosts have CPU cycles left to be used for compression, it will. And basically, because this is a demo, nothing much is happening, so it can take as many cycles as it wants. And that's the result, 8 seconds.
So let me highlight, that's 41 seconds to 8 seconds. And this is, you upgrade to 2012 R2, you get this by default. It's now there, you don't need any special hardware. And as Didier mentioned, what we're doing is, when you do the live migration, we check all the workload that's happening in all the virtual machines, we figure out how much CPU is not being used, and we use that to compress the data that's being sent across live migration. So we've tested this on active systems with various workloads. With an idle system, we do tend to see these incredible, you know, 8, 10x performance improvements. With a heavily loaded system, we still consistently see a 2 to 3x performance improvement in live migration time.
So now we've switched over to multi-channel, and there you have two flavors, right? You've got multi-channel or possibly SMB Direct. So we'll start with multi-channel, and we'll kick it off. And again, have a look at the CPU, just as a comparison. Take that in mind, make a mental picture. Have a look at the NICs now. Ah, we are now sending and receiving over both NICs, because multi-channel has that capability. And that's nice, because now you have 20 gigs at your disposal to do your transfer. So we expect it to be about twice as fast. And it consumes some CPU cycles. Let's have a look, just taking in mind. And again, also look at the task manager. What do you see? 10 gigabit, 10 gigabit. So you're really getting line speed. Now, I've tweaked the system a bit, but as you can see, it works quite well. And you can have this today in your data center if you want. Look at that. I love it.
So twice as fast because we're able to use all the network connectivity, whereas before we were only using one connection.
Indeed. So now we're going to do the dangerous part of the demo. And I've put it in a separate folder so I wouldn't enable it by mistake before I was ready.
So what's happening right now is Didier's enabling a functionality called RDMA, which is a hardware offload for networking. And it's used by SMB, and in 2012 R2, it's used by live migration if you choose to do live migration over SMB.
So let's close this PowerShell script and go for the other one. Oh. So my ASCII art, I forgot to make it smaller for this demo. I didn't have time to type it all in. So I'm sorry. It says SMB Direct, just for your information.
Well, we'll take your word on it.
Okay, thank you very much. So let's kick it off, and basically the live migration starts. You can take a look at the CPU. Perhaps you notice something. It seems to be a bit lower, doesn't it?
Seems a lot lower.
Yeah. I'm being modest. I'm from Europe, right? Look at the throughput in the NICs. But now, look at the host and task manager. Where's my bandwidth? Everything is offloaded to the NIC. It's doing all the hard work. It copies the data memory to memory from host to host using both NICs. So I have very low latency, very high speed, and I'm not using CPU cycles. And I love that in my environment because I use those CPU cycles to do virtual RSS, to do all kinds of other cool stuff. This is how we get a tremendous VM density even under high load. And all of this stuff makes me so happy because I'm going to get audited because one of the applications in our environment is too slow. And I am so ready for them, believe me.
So let's see the numbers.
They're about the same, but you have the other benefits you just mentioned.
Right. So let's jump back to the presentation. So you may be asking, why does this matter? You know, because you saw the first live migration here was 41 seconds. That's pretty fast. Well, the problem we're going after here is the problem of patching and maintaining your environment. Because in the real world, you know, if you're a service provider, if you're doing a large enterprise cloud deployment, you're not live migrating 4 virtual machines. Instead, you're going to have, you know, 1,000 virtual machines on, you know, a dozen or so Hyper-V servers. And when it's time to patch them, you need to live migrate all those virtual machines around so that you can flow the patch through the system. Now, if you don't have this technology, if you just have 2012, we've done the math. You know, a typical deployment, 8-node cluster or 1,000 virtual machines, it can take upwards of 8 hours. You can turn on compression, and you can halve that on the spot. Now, and finally, you can turn on SMB Direct, and we start seeing that get down to under an hour. So let me put this in human terms. Let's do another show of hands. How many people here, if they had to deploy a patch to their cluster, would hit go and walk away in full confidence that everything was going to work fine? We got a couple of people. How many people here would hit the button and then sit there and watch the system? Yeah, that's what I would do. So what we're saying is 2012, whenever you have to patch your cloud, that is a really crappy day. That is you just sitting in your office going, come on, I want to be doing other things, but I'm not going to take my eyes off this. Do nothing, no new hardware, just 2012 R2. We just took that from a day to an afternoon. Invest in RDMA, SMB Direct. We've just taken that to something you can do over lunch. You know, and you can be off doing more important things, more fun things, than babysitting a system that's deploying patches. So the final thing I often get asked, hey, we have compression, we have SMB, we have RDMA. When should we be using what? We've done a lot of testing on this, and very simple rule of thumb. Look at how much network bandwidth you have available for live migration. If it's 10 gigabit or less, use compression. If it's over 10 gigabit, use SMB, SMB Direct. As I said, we've done a lot of testing, and consistently, that's the guidance we give. So I'm going to have to really run along now because I'm about to get in trouble for going over time. So I think we're going to skip that demo.
Okay, no problem.
I see you're preparing for that one. So the next thing that we did a lot of investment was in Linux. So we've been talking a lot lately about enabling Linux on our cloud platforms. And there are a couple of things I want to call out here. So on one level, here are the features that we've now enabled with 2012 R2. We've added support for dynamic memory. We've added support for online backup. We've added support for VHDX resize. And we've added an improved video driver. Now, how many people here have Linux running in their environment? Fair show of hands. How many of you have a good backup strategy for your Linux environment, wait for it, that is not a shell script that copies files? Got one person, two people. This amazes me. People do not protect their Linux workloads the way they should. Now, the great thing about the work that we've done here is if you have an enterprise-grade Windows-based backup solution, you stick Linux in a virtual machine on Hyper-V, you don't have to do anything extra to protect those workloads. You now get zero downtime, no file system consistent backups of those virtual machines like all your other virtual machines. We've also done some amazing work with the Linux kernel to enable full dynamic memory. This is hot add and remove of memory in response to what's happening inside the Linux virtual machine. So unfortunately, I have to skip over this demo so I don't get in too much trouble. Final thing I want to talk about is Hyper-V Replica. Now, hopefully, how many people here saw the announcement that we're supporting Replica to Azure? So I'm really excited. I'm really happy to see that come out because it goes really well with some of the other enhancements that we've made in Replica in Windows Server 2012 R2. So for those of you who aren't aware, Hyper-V Replica is the built-in disaster recovery solution that we provided in Windows Server 2012. In 2012 R2, we added some extra functionality. The first thing, and this was a very common request, was we allowed you to configure how frequently we send data. In 2012, replication happened every 5 minutes. And we actually had people come back and ask for faster and slower. People wanted faster if they were doing this in a data center or on a metropolitan area network and going like, I just want that sent every time. So we now allow you to say 30 seconds. We had people say, I want it slower because I'm trying to do this over a satellite link, you know, to an office that's in the middle of nowhere. And so we now provide that option as well. We say we'll send it every 15 minutes. But the one that really excites me is extended replication. Because what we allow you to do is we now allow you to replicate from a primary location to a secondary location, and then from a secondary location to a tertiary location, to a third location. So why would you want to do that? Well, let me paint the very simple picture for you. The chain you want to have is you want to have your virtual machine running in your main office. You care about this, so you're going to have it replicating to a secondary office, and then you're going to have it replicating on again to a local service provider or to Azure. And now you have a complete disaster recovery story where if you have site down, great, fail over to your other site. But if there's a real catastrophe and it's a case of like, well, no one in my state has power anymore, then you have the third option. You know, and this gives just a great level of flexibility and control and ability to respond to these sorts of disaster situations. So, I am going to wrap up here. We did have some other marketing discussion stuff, but we are a couple of minutes over. So at this stage, I would like to stop and open for questions. We have some mics around, so if anyone has questions about that, please wander out to a mic and let us know. Oh, and while we're doing this, I know some people have other commitments, so thank you for staying through to the end, and I hope you have a good show. Is the mic not turned on? Okay, just yell it out to me and I'll repeat it. Oh, now it's turned on.
Okay, so I'm still on 2008 R2. What's the migration path of those virtual machines into 2012 R2?
So the first question I'm going to ask is, are you running standalone servers or are you running clusters?
Cluster, three-node cluster.
Okay, side note, that is the most common configuration I get asked about. If I had a dime for every person who said to me, Ben, I've got a three-node 2008 R2 cluster and I need to upgrade it to 2012 R2, I'd probably be able to buy a coffee. So what you want to do is you want to look into a functionality that's part of failover clustering that's called the copy cluster roles wizard. Now, the thing I do want to be really clear about is this is a process that will involve downtime. Now, we only support doing no downtime upgrade 2012 to 2012 R2. So 2008 R2 to 2012 R2 does involve downtime, but we have a wizard that's called the copy cluster roles wizard. And if you do, we actually have some great presentations online about this. If you do a search for 2008 R2, 2012 R2, copy cluster roles wizard.
I've got a step-by-step on my blog, by the way.
Yeah, you'll find a number of posts out there, and this is a process that just steps through it out. It gets your virtual machines across, it gets your storage across, and it does it in as efficient a manner as possible. If you plan this well, you can actually do it with, you know, sub 30 minutes of downtime as you pull those
virtual machines. Or you can do way better than that, really. Yeah, trust me.
Yeah, I know. So he has blog posts. We also, there's been a video that's been posted by a program manager at Microsoft called Rob Hindman. That's R-O-B-H-I-N-D-M-A-N. So I do want to be clear, it is a bit of a complicated process, which is why I'm not telling it to you here. But there's a lot of material available about that.
Is there a lab?
I do not know if we have a lab, unfortunately. So the question was, what's the process for standalone? So for standalone, and I know I'm going to make server people cringe, but please take a leap of faith, in-place upgrade works. Like, we test that a lot. So my number one recommendation for standalone is shut down the VMs, do an in-place upgrade, and everything will come up and work. If you're not going to go there, then we've also done a lot of work to make sure that even for 2008 R2, your other option is backup and restore. So you can backup and restore. The final thing that we've provided is if you hopefully go out on a limb, hopefully you have your servers configured so that your virtual machines are stored on a separate partition to your system drive. So if you have that, you can just take those virtual machines from 2008 R2 and import them on 2012 R2, and we connect them up and they work.
You liked it?
So there are a couple options. Honestly, in-place upgrade works really well.
I know that
no server person will ever believe me when I say that.
Okay, with me, I've been basically new as a server administrator, and the biggest challenge that I have is that we're still supporting 2003 servers and 2008. We still have the 2008 R2 servers. When it comes to patching, it's very consuming, especially if the server doesn't come online, or after a while, finding out that some patches did cause some issues on the server. What do we have in the 2012 R2 that to make sure that, you know, if the server does have some kind of issue, what kind of detection system that we have for patching to say that, okay, this is what caused the issue, because it takes me hours and hours just to find out what really caused it and turns out to be a patching issue.
So really for that sort of environment, you need to be looking at System Center Configuration Manager. It's our orchestration engine for patch deployment and management, and it will do all that identification and remediation for you. So I'm assuming you're not using System Center Configuration Manager in your environment today.
SCCM?
Yeah.
We are using that, but at the same time, you know, like about a month ago, I deployed patches, which there were about eight of them that went through, and it was one of the 2008 R2 server. A month later, we found out that it was the issue that was caused on that server had some different services were caused by those patches. So just want to see what's out there on 2012 R2 and just to save us some time.
This is a conversation for SCCM people, unfortunately, which I'm not super well versed with.
Gotcha.
If you come down to the showroom floor tomorrow morning, I can make sure we get you in contact with those people.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Any way to convert from generation one VMs to generation two?
So the question is, any way to convert from generation one to generation two? Yes, one of our fantastic program managers, a Mr. John Howard, has actually written and published a script that will go through and do the conversion process for you. And it's a fantastic script. Do you know what it's called?
I don't know what it's called. I've used it. It works. And I have many of my MVP colleagues who are now using it just to do mass migrations even.
So I can't remember the name of the script, but I know if you do a web search for John Howard Generation 2 Virtual Machine, right, you'll find the blog post that he did. He did a series of blog posts where he includes the script that does the conversion process.
Thank you.
Hi. Any plans for supporting a PCI device as a pass-through into the guest?
So the question is, any plans for supporting PCI device pass-through? We do not support it today, and I can't talk about future plans, sorry. As I like to say, I like my job.
Okay, thank you.
So we might wrap up now. Thank you, everyone, and hope you enjoy the rest of the show.